if organizations like Commonwealth and Heritage, if all we do is stop bad things, well, that means America declines more slowly. And that's not what I signed up for. And it's not what my children want to part ways with their dad in the morning and maybe not see him for several days afterwards in order to accomplish. So we want to accomplish good things too. Welcome back to the Kevin Roberts Show. I love getting out of Washington, D.C. In fact, I get out of Washington, D.C. every single day because I live in the free state of Virginia. And I am back in America, outside Washington, D.C., in the great state of Pennsylvania, which gets a bad rap. I mean, truly bad rap. Remember, Pennsylvania is the birthplace of this great country. And about half of the people in Pennsylvania, in fact, I would argue a little more than half of the people in Pennsylvania, actually vote the right way. And they want to keep America, America. And most of the remainder actually can be on our side if we package and message our ideas in the right way. There is no person on the planet more responsible for beginning to make that a reality than my really good friend I'm sitting with here in the capital of Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Charles Mitchell, the president and CEO of Commonwealth Foundation. Thanks for making time for this.
Kevin, I'm delighted to have you in a proper Commonwealth. Virginia is fine, but we are so pleased to have you in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. You should come more often, and I know that you will.
I will. In fact, I love the state immensely. So, in fact, one of the reasons that I'm a little late getting here is, you know, I'm a history nerd. I can't pass in my truck the battlefield at Gettysburg.
I was thinking without pulling you might off. Have had to stop.
And there. I kind of get lost track of time. My colleagues who are here with me know that I do these things. So thank you for your forbearance. Most of all, Charles Mitchell, thank you for being a cheerful warrior for the everyday Pennsylvanian and increasingly the everyday American.
It is my pleasure. Glad to have you and glad to do this work. This work is inspired here at the Commonwealth Foundation by the Heritage Foundation, so I find it to be most perfect that we're talking today.
Well, let's start there. When did Commonwealth get started and what do you focus on?
We have just passed our 35th anniversary. In fact, we're going to celebrate it with a big party here shortly in the birthplace of freedom and liberty, Philadelphia. Also gets a bad rap, an even worse rap than the rest of the state.
Because of its sports teams.
The sports teams, the attitude, some other things. We could talk about that. But Commonwealth Foundation was literally birthed from the loins of the Heritage Foundation. Our founder worked in the Reagan administration, and he worked very closely with the Heritage Foundation on President Reagan's policy agenda. We all remember how successful that was. And at the end of the administration, he came back here to Pennsylvania and said, there's nothing like the Heritage Foundation here. So he called up some successful business people and said, I want to start an independent voice for Pennsylvanians here. That became the Commonwealth Foundation. Don Eberle was his name. He was the founding president, the principal funder. Our course, was a gentleman named Alex McKenna, chairman of Kenna Metals out in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And from there, we have built this freedom machine.
How long have you been here?
I came back to America from where you live. I also lived in the Commonwealth of Virginia. My wife and I moved back here in 2010. My wife was pregnant at the time with the first of our now four daughters. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful place to raise a family here and to help out other families through what we do at Commonwealth.
So Charles, one of the things I love doing with this show is to highlight the stories of our guests, that is their journey to be doing what they're doing now. And yours, like I think every guest, is very interesting. So tell us how Charles Mitchell is a decade plus into his leadership, into his time at Commonwealth.
Well, it happened on the second Tuesday of my freshman year of college. I grew up in Pennsylvania, as you know, but I didn't grow up here. We're in the state capital of Harrisburg. I grew up in the Philadelphia area and pretty, you know, I think normal family. People did normal things. No one knew what the phrase think tank was where I grew up.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. I had never heard of the Heritage Foundation or the conservative movement or any of these things. My Mitchell forebears, all my male, you know, relatives back in the generations were railroaders. They worked on the railroad. My the other side of the family, teachers, used car salesmen, things like that. So I thought I'd probably do something relatively normal with my life, maybe be a teacher or something like that. I love history as you do. So my first career aspiration was to be a history teacher. Well, I enrolled at Bucknell University, about an hour and change north of where we are. And on the second Tuesday of my freshman year, I had an 8 o'clock geology lab. Back in those days, we didn't have these devices that now consume our lives. There were no screens in classrooms.
You remember. You can relate.
I remember well.
Yeah.
Anyway, 8 o'clock was a 4-hour lab. And from 8 a.m. till just before noon that day, I was completely cut off from the world. And that was the way geology labs were back then. So when I walked out of class, just about lunchtime, and I was new, you know, it was just the beginning of freshman year, but there was already a routine. The routine was on that particular day, I would wander back to my dorm and everybody would be congregating, getting ready to go to this one particular place where you could get custom pizza. Big deal for a college student. So I finished my rock project or whatever it was. I go back to my dorm and I start looking for my friends and they're nowhere to be found. Can't find them anywhere. And I keep looking and I keep looking and I keep looking and I find that they're all in the basement of our dorm. Well, again, this is the Stone Age. So back then, there was only one television in the whole dorm. It was in the basement. And they were all crowded around it. And they were watching on repeat what I then saw for the first time. Planes slamming into the World Trade Center, people jumping out of buildings, the buildings collapsing, Lower Manhattan being turned into a living hell, the Pentagon on fire, a field in Pennsylvania. You know where I'm going with this. It was September 11, 2001. And I'll be the first to say, Kevin, that many people were inspired to action that day, and all of them are more noble than me. I have friends who joined the military and did all sorts of things like that. What happened to me as a punk college freshman was that I was inspired to do the stuff that you and I do now, to speak, to write, to advocate for what I felt our country needed. And I never imagined where it would take me. It took me here, clearly. That's why I'm telling you that story in response to your question. And very brief summary, how that happened was I became a newspaper editor and writer at Bucknell, both in the mainstream campus paper and in a conservative newspaper, which I became the first editor. I was almost immediately put on trial, threatened with expulsion.
In 2001.
Yeah, and most people didn't. I mean, people now get that this is a thing. I'm telling you, in 2001, 2002, people did not get this was a thing. And it was a lonely battle in some respects, but not that lonely because I discovered the conservative movement. I didn't first discover the Heritage Foundation. I actually discovered the Commonwealth Foundation sooner. The gentleman who later hired me here, Matt Briette, was the president of the Commonwealth Foundation at that time. He and people at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, FIRE, the Leadership Institute, organizations that have many common, you know, ties with some leaders of the Heritage Foundation, came alongside me and taught me my first really important lesson in how David can defeat Goliath. Because I was the David, I mean, being persecuted by the top administrators of the school. What I learned was you got to take the fight off the campus to the people who have the money. And if donors to Bucknell at that time heard what was being done or they were trying to do to me, well, then things would change.
Well, and if you fast forward, and we're actually going to come back to 2001 and two in a moment, but if you fast forward to the 2020s,
yes,
and you think about of all of the bad things that happen on college campuses, perhaps among the worst is the disconnect between the reality day-to-day on campus and what board members about. And the flip side of that, the good news, you and I are wired very, very similarly in that we try to always find that silver lining or that flip side of the challenge. And that's really where our conversation will go momentarily. But in the 2020s, more and more board members are wise to this.
Absolutely.
And in this very year, as we sit here in 2024,
that's true.
What's changed in America in the meantime, both good and bad, since 2001 and 2002?
Awesome question. I think you partially answered it. I think many people, including college trustees, but not just college trustees, I think just normal Americans, are much more aware of the problems that we face. That's a good thing. That provides opportunity. I would also say, too, that the very same problems that became personal for me in 2001 and 2002 have gotten much worse because they didn't start then. This, for example, corruption of our institutions, I would argue, started at the latest in the 60s, maybe under the progressives 100 or more years ago. But whenever you want to place it, it had been in there, it had been in the body, so to speak, for a long time, and it has metastasized since then. So I think it's a good thing that awareness is much greater. Problems? I think the problems are much worse than they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think sometimes I surprise people. You and I have had this conversation several times since we have gotten to know each other by saying, I happen to think America is relatively weak. Because, although I don't think that that's irreversible, so just inject a little bit of sunshine into that, there are still strong parts about America. But if you contrast America today in the 2020s with the America that I knew growing up in the 1970s, intellectually often I'm in the 1770s, in the 1970s and 1980s, so we don't edit on this show. My colleague behind the camera saying, that was awesome. We're just going to roll with it.
I love it.
Yeah. You see, Freudian slip here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
But America in the 1970s and 80s had its problems. But, you know, Reagan, for example, thinking about the origins of heritage, said that there can be a new page that we turn. And so you and I can talk very candidly, this is the point of mentioning that, about the problems that exist in America generally, or in the case of the work of the Commonwealth Foundation, Pennsylvania specifically, because we want to orient the work that we do around solutions to the real problems that affect real people, as opposed to what the swamp in D.C., the swamp in Harrisburg would want us to really be focused on. So that leads to this question. What are some things that Commonwealth has changed, obviously for the better, that 5, 10 years ago, people told you, you wouldn't be able to change?
Yeah. Kevin, everything that we are doing today in 2024 is something that 10 years ago people laughed at and missed out. Now, do we do what we do just to prove them wrong? No. We do it because it's right for the people we serve.
But I love proving them wrong too. That's great.
I'll give you a few examples. You know, the conventional wisdom here, yes, there is a swamp here in Harrisburg. Very analogous. I used to live in D.C., so it all seems very familiar. And so, for example, one of the bottom lines is, well, you know, government just has to grow a lot. There's all these problems. We need to spend more money. We have a flat tax here in Pennsylvania. It's one of our saving graces compared to Maryland, for example, which you drove through, and New Jersey and some of our neighboring states, 3.07%. It's really a saving grace. Now, there are a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, it's just way too low. You got to raise it. You got to make it progressive, whatever. Well, here at Commonwealth, in the last 10 years or so, we have defeated $33 billion in tax increases on working people. And just last December, right before Christmas, we defeated what would have been the largest tax increase in Pennsylvania history. Now, I think if that at all we've done in the last 10 years, that'd be pretty good. And when people ask me what I do, that's usually the first thing I tell them because that's personal for most people. One of those last tax increases we defeated would have been a $1,400 increase for the average family.
And
that's groceries.
Yeah, then that's terrible in any year, but especially right now, where the rate of inflation is almost, the long-term consequences of this too are bad, but the rate of inflation is something that costs people, regular people, their habits at the grocery store.
Yes, yes. But I hasten to say, Kevin, like, I believe in stopping bad things. I can give you lots of other bad things that we've stopped. But I believe if organizations like Commonwealth and Heritage, if all we do is stop bad things, well, that means America declines more slowly. And that's not what I signed up for. And it's not what my children want to part ways with their dad in the morning and maybe not see him for several days afterwards in order to accomplish. So we want to accomplish good things too. And that's, to me, part of what makes what you said at the top of the show resonate, that, you know, a lot of people look at my state and say, well, it's kind of hopeless. Have we had a lot of people who wear a blue jersey in prominent office here? Yeah, sure. Ever since 2015, for example, we've had a Democratic governor. During that time, we have accomplished bipartisan pension reform, lauded by Pew Charitable Trusts. We have our long-term unfunded liabilities and all that stuff heading in the right direction. Now, that's a nerdy issue that when people ask me what I do, I don't say that. But
it's vital.
If you don't do that, we are going to raise taxes. And you are going to have your standard of living degraded. So that's one example. But my favorite example, what makes my heart beat every day, is not just fighting for workers and for families who are trying to buy groceries, but for the most defenseless people in our society. And that is children who are being subjected to failing, violent government schools and told that that's what they have to do. It isn't what they have to do. And here in Pennsylvania, as we sit here today, during these last 10 years, we have created over $500 million, over $500 million in school choice scholarships. We invented the idea of a school choice scholarship and tax credit scholarship here about 20 years ago. And we have massively increased the funding available to those families in these last 10 years. We are on the verge now. And as you know from a previous conversation we had in your office, you and I are a little bit of a race right now, because although you live in the Commonwealth of Virginia, I know you identify as a Texan, you did great work at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. We're in a little bit of a race to see, is Pennsylvania or Texas going to be the next state to not just have those tax credit scholarships, but to have education savings accounts? We have a Democratic governor here. Your former state of Texas, or your former country, I guess I should say, of Texas, has a great governor.
Good correction.
Doing some great work. We'll see which one of us gets there first. But that is now a thing in Pennsylvania. And in my context here, I regard it as one of our achievements that our Democratic governor and prominent Democratic elected officials are, in fact, endorsing school choice. And not just the current program, but education savings accounts. We're on the verge of getting that done. And I am confident I'm going to see the day soon, and our whole country is going to see the day soon, when we get that done. And getting that done in a purple state under a Democratic governor, I would argue, is good for our whole country to show that you can actually do that in a state like this.
Well, some people in the audience will be surprised to hear that the state of play for education freedom in Pennsylvania is as positive as it is. So hats off to you, and for that matter, to your governor for understanding. In addition to the great work that you have done on school choice, has something changed in the political calculus of Democrats in Pennsylvania to make them at least willing to have the conversation on school choice?
Yes. Yes. And Kevin, I'm cognizant of the fact that you and I both run 501c3s. I'm not going to support or oppose any political candidates in this discussion, nor are you. I'm just going to speak facts. So in this building that you and I are sitting in Harrisburg, there are two organizations, not one. One of them is the Commonwealth Foundation, of which I'm proud to be the head. The other is something called Commonwealth Partners, which not very many years ago was an idea, and it was an idea that a lot of people said was impossible. It is now the home of the largest political action committee in the state, bigger than our next door neighbors, which, if you didn't see it on the way in, is the PSEA, that's the Pennsylvania State Extortion, I mean, Education Association, otherwise known as our largest so-called teachers union, which doesn't actually advocate for the best interest of teachers. It simply fights to keep children in failing and violent hellholes. They've criticized me from time to time for using that word, but again, I believe it is factual.
It's true, and it's really the school administrators union, if it's anything.
Yeah. So, have the political incentives changed? Yeah, because 10 years ago, basically, the only people out there, there were people out there with good ideas and bad ideas on education policy, but the only people out there who could help you campaign for office were the people who wanted to trap children in these hellholes. That has changed. That's not what Kamala's Foundation does. But I would argue, especially in terms of how do we take the country back, you need organizations with the right ideas, like our organizations have. You also need other organizations that are making sure people with the right ideas and courage and values, the kind of people that we invite to speak at our organizations and that carry the policy that they stand for, are actually getting in there. And if they get attacked, are being defended. Our movement has to do that too, that is one of the things that our movement has done in Pennsylvania. And that's one of the things that I have attempted to dedicate myself to as I, since I moved back here in 2010, is not just build my thing, Commonwealth Foundation, but to build a vibrant freedom movement here in America's largest swing state, the most important and, of course, best state in the country.
So I'll momentarily ask you to explain how certain lessons from Pennsylvania might be transferred to other states, mostly for the benefit of the audience. We're always trying to give folks things that they can do. People will email me, or if I see them in person, they'll say, keep giving us homework assignments. But one more question about school choice. In this gentleman's bet that you and I have, if I lose, which is to say that Pennsylvania beats Texas in this race toward very expansive school choice, you get a platter of really good Texas barbecue.
Mm.
If you lose, which is to say Texas beats Pennsylvania, what in the world is the equivalent of Texas barbecue in Pennsylvania?
Well,
it's a hard question, isn't it?
It is an excellent question. And I don't know if this is true in your country, but here, that's a profoundly regional question, right? So if we were in Philadelphia, you'd say cheesesteak, right?
Yeah, everybody cheers that.
But that's not a Pennsylvania thing. That's a Philadelphia thing. So you're asking me, you're not asking the state in general. What I would say, Kevin, is that I live about 20 minutes from here, and my home is surrounded by farms. And one of my favorite aspects of the part of Pennsylvania that I now inhabit is that the delicacies at those farms are available to me at a fabulously affordable price. And one of my favorite delicacies is a local farm that has the best New York strip steaks that I've ever tasted.
Sounds like a deal.
So I'll trade you a New York strip for your Texas barbecue.
I'll be looking forward to it. So I keep going there, but maybe we ought to move on. Pennsylvania is in better shape than people realize in terms of policy, as you've just outlined. What lessons here are easily transferable to other states, particularly people who are watching or listening to this, Charles, in purple states, or maybe they're living in red states trending purple, or as the case is, maybe they're in blue states that are trending the right way?
Mm-hmm. I think the lesson's pretty simple, and I think it is a huge part of the way that you are leading the Heritage Foundation and the way that you led the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's why we became friends, is conservatives have to play offense. And we have to play offense in season and out of season. Obviously, it's a biblical term. I'm sure that not everyone reading embraces everything in the Bible, or hearing, listening embraces everything that's in the Bible. You don't have to, but you do have to embrace that if you want to win in this business. And what I mean by that is I observe that the left plays offense in season and out of season. Our neighbors at the Extortion Association, for example, they never quit. Their people are in our Capitol. The Capitol, as you know, right across the street from here, right up the steps. They're in there all the time. Now, in contrast to my people, they're in there about 3 days a week, 4 hours a day. My people work harder. But they never quit. They never lay them off. They never say, oh, we lost and we're just done. They are always there. And politicians know it. Or I'll give you a more macro example. Look at what the left has done in Texas. Okay? Again, I'm not going to endorse a political candidate, but I'll make a prediction. Ted Cruz will win by about 5 points if they're spending about $500 million. And most people would say, oh, Texas, I thought that was a red state. Yeah, well, guess what? The left saw an opportunity to make it a swing state, and they have been assiduously building and playing offense there for 20 years. I would argue we have done basically the same thing in reverse in Pennsylvania. We said 20 years ago, this does not have to be a playground for progressives. This is where America was born. We can make, not just politically, because we're not a political organization, but make our ideas, our values competitive here. And we have in all the ways that you talked about earlier. Why? How? By playing offense in season and out of season. And I would argue everyone listening should do that no matter where they live. The scariest example, I think, is actually not your former country, but Georgia.
Yes, that is the scariest.
How many people were shocked to see Georgia vote the way that it did in 2020? Well, again, that the left, all their solutions are wrong, okay? Like, all of them are wrong. I'm not giving them any props for the substance of what they do and what they believe. But I do think you have to give them props sometimes for their strategy. They infiltrate institutions, play offense, and they do it in season and out of season. Even when they get punched in the face and they lose, they pick themselves up and keep going.
They're masterful tacticians at the art of politics. And the example of Georgia, I think, is the best. But also think about Colorado.
Yes.
I mean, some younger conservatives know that it flipped, but they don't realize what a significant flip that was, because Colorado, going from the deep, reliably red state that it was for decades to what it is now, which is basically out of reach for the Republican presidential nominee, whomever he or she would be in whichever year, is astounding. Virginia, not that far behind in terms of the surprise. So now, I happen to think that at no point in the near term will Texas flip, but that does not mean that the left will stop trying.
I'm not saying it will, right? But I think...
But it's certainly narrower, right?
And that's $500 million.
That could be spent elsewhere.
That is now unavailable for gaining anything for our cause. It will have to be spent on defense.
Yeah. So the converse is true, which is, at least in Heritage, I know you think this way too, that if you think about the narrow defeat that Lee Zeldin had in the gubernatorial race in New York, there were some issues in that 2022 election cycle, and I'm just speaking as a political nerd, right? That as an observer, that were unique, or at least distinctive to that year, but some of them have become longer running, like concerns over public safety, concerns over a radical leftist agenda on illegal immigration that is having a real impact on the daily lives of New Yorkers. At Heritage, we believe that states like New York, perhaps even states like Washington State, at least once in a while, might elect people who are less liberal, they're more conservative. We have to have that mindset, is what you're saying.
Yes.
In every place. And even in a place like Texas, one of the ways that I think the political center right will prevent Texas from being flipped is by going back on offense in the cities. For too long, they decided that municipal elections were unimportant and that whoever the mayor of Austin was going to be, he or she was going to be sort of weird. Being weird and center left is almost endearing right now in Austin, Texas, because what happened for a decade or more was a series of radically left mayors, city councilmen, who were really trying to mirror what was going on in San Francisco. So this is a real call to arms, not just to be on offense, but also for people to remember that the most important action politically is the action nearest you. In your state, your local community, really being involved with school boards and town councils and city councils and county commissions. So as you sort of take this lesson and think about the upcoming work that Commonwealth will be doing in the Pennsylvania legislature, what are the priorities you're working on here before we then draw back and talk about the future of American conservatism?
Sure. We are continuing forward with everything that you and I talked about a few minutes ago. A number one priority, be Texas. Be the next state to create education savings accounts. And it is within reach. And we do have a unique opportunity. We have the unfortunate reality of a full-time legislature that meets every year.
It's very unfortunate.
You didn't have that in your former country. So good news for me, though, is I have a chance to win our bet here in 2024 because my legislature is meeting. So that's a number one.
It's almost like having bad officiating in a game, but I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. Hey, I got a chance to help children go, so I'm going to do it.
Amen.
And beyond that, we have a huge battle with the governor's budget. He proposed all sorts of ridiculous, crazy spending programs that we, of course, have to beat those. We're pretty good at that. We'll have that discussion. The other big piece that we haven't talked about, but I know this is very important to the Heritage Foundation, and it's very important to Commonwealth as well, is the whole issue of energy. And this place where you are could be, should be, the energy capital, not just of America, but of the world. There's more gas under the ground of Pennsylvania than Saudi Arabia. Again, I'm not trying to, this is not about beating Texas. I know Texas is a very important energy state as well. We have self-inflicted wounds here. We could be in Pennsylvania for supplying gas instead of Putin, but we're shooting ourselves in the foot with regulatory issues, with failure to build pipelines, with stupid stuff. The stupidest of all is that our previous governor attempted to basically do a version of the Green New Deal here called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And our current governor said he didn't really support it, but is now suing in court to make it happen and has proposed his own scheme that basically is the same stuff with a different name. Well, this is why our institutions exist. And especially in the environment that you just talked about earlier, inflation, all the rest of it, if you poll people here in Pennsylvania, ask them, where are you feeling the biggest pinch economically right now? It's not food prices. It is energy prices.
And that will only get worse.
Yes.
In the next months.
Yes. So again, are we in a really perilous place?
Yes.
This is really bad. These are horrifically bad ideas. And people are pushing them in court and yada, yada. But we are also in an opportune place because the people of Pennsylvania overwhelmingly oppose these schemes. And if they simply know about them, we will stop.
Let me ask you a question that would be relevant for, I guess, any governor who is part of the Democratic Party. And then this is one political nerd to another, neither of us picking sides in this. People who listen to this show, watch the show routinely, know that I critique both parties regularly because both of them suffer from a lack of vision, or at least one of them does. The Republicans. Your governor's a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Your governor, as I understand it, has occasional thoughts about future office. And that's fine. Men and women can have aspirations. It would seem to me that one of the dynamics that he faces, if in fact those are true, those aspirations, rumors about those aspirations are true, is that he's got to play the radical leftist game on energy, on the Green New Deal, in order to have bona fides to do that. What do you think of my thesis that if in fact the Republican Party has a trifecta at the federal level, which I think is more likely than not at this point, Republicans recapture the White House, hold the House, recapture the Senate, and therefore presumably put the brakes on the Green New Deal, does it become easier in Pennsylvania to maybe get to the point where you're taking advantage of that natural resource of natural gas here?
I think it does. I also think, again, this is where conservatives have to be honest about what's bad, but also be savvy enough to flip it over and say, aha, that's where it creates opportunity. So is there a radical extremist wackadoodle green contingent that our governor has to genuflect to in order to get to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, which is what he's wanted to do since he was this tall and like thinks about all the time?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's bad. And they're bad. And they want to hurt people. They want to do things that will hurt people.
I don't think they are trying to hurt people, but they don't understand that's what they're going to do. Okay. Anyway, they're bad. They're really bad. They're powerful. However, a person like him is in a political vice because there is another really, really, really powerful interest in Pennsylvania and also nationally that you didn't name, which is the trade unions, core constituency of the Democratic Party. And you know what they do in a lot of parts of Pennsylvania? Building gas wells and pipelines
and other things that all revolve around getting gas out of the ground
and to people not just in Pennsylvania, but in other northeastern states that aren't smart enough to do it or that don't have the natural resources. I won't name any names, New York, and beyond that, right? So that's an opportunity for our movement, is to make a politician, again, this is not a political comment, this is a policy process comment, make a politician who's trying to satisfy two interest groups simultaneously choose. That's a bad position for him to be in. What a politician in that position will try to do is talk out of both sides of his mouth. Say one thing to this interest group, say another, and come out smelling like a rose. If we fight every day, in season and out of season, if we build strong institutions and we garner support, not just financial support, but people who carry these ideas to their lawmakers and ultimately lawmakers who carry them into the halls of power. So that's a lot to it.
What I love about this response is that you, without using this phrase, you really touch on the necessity of the craft of politics for the conservative movement. Conservatives are really good on ideas and policies. And when it gets down to it, we're really good at killing what we think is the bad legislation. We're not nearly as good at casting a vision for the future, even though we believe that, hopefully live that out in our personal lives, something we'll come to before we close. But my point is about the craft of politics, that part of that is doing to the left what they do to the right all the time, which is to create this vice, to underscore the reality of this vice, as you put it, for your governor, or as is commonly described, to create more wedge issues for the left. They do this to us all the time. They have one issue in 2024 at the national level on which, only one, on which they are trusted more, the left, than they are the right, and that is abortion. And while that has always been a contentious issue in this country since the early 1970s, the right has allowed that to become one. I just want to use that as an example, not necessarily discuss it in detail. The point is, as you and I pivot in this conversation to looking to the future of the conservative movement, in addition to the ideas and obviously some of the people and some of the policies, we have to be better about the practicing of the politics. We have, I think, this aversion to the word political. And what I try to remind people in Washington is that if you're a conservative and you're being political, it doesn't mean that you're swearing allegiance to one political party over another. In fact, it means that you're being equally opportunistic and equally critical of the party apparatuses that exist and using them to the ends of the conservative movement, which transcends both of those party apparatuses. In other words, Charles, and sorry for the long-winded windup to this question, we have to be better at that as a conservative movement. And if that happens, then I think you're going to see, as is the case right now in American politics, more Republicans behave better and probably a handful of Democrats be willing to vote the right way.
Totally agree. And we've lived that here in Pennsylvania. That's why a lot of the things we've talked about has happened. We've hired a few people here, and I tell them, you know, before they get an offer or accept it, like, if all you want is to express your ideas and feel that you're right, this isn't the place for you to work. That's not what we do here. We are here to turn these ideas into law. And that requires putting them through a process that has a craft associated with it. And I entirely agree. We can't just have the right ideas. We have to be better at the craft too. That is not a contradiction. That is just the fact of the matter. And we as a movement, I agree with you, Kevin. We as a movement need to become excellent at both.
And you and I both have many friends in the conservative movement, and so many of them are leaders of policy organizations. You and I both abhor the phrase think tank, and so we're not going to use it other than that reference in this conversation. But if you think about the future of the conservative movement, and obviously these men and women we know, I think, are vital parts of that because of their understanding of what you just said, their practicing what you just said. But give us a sense into your crystal ball, 5, 10, maybe 20 years down the road. What does the conservative movement need to do better in order for it not just to be a governing majority, that's important, but for it to really capture the imagination of this next generation of Americans?
Hey. Boy, that is the question. I think we've talked about many of the elements from my perspective. The one I would add is, I would think expansively. And what I mean by that is, I have observed in some quarters what I would call a turf consciousness and a limited pie mentality, such as, there's a certain amount of political influence out there and I got to get my piece and my piece comes at your expense. Or there's a certain amount of money out there from patriotic people who want to support organizations like the Commonwealth Foundation or the Heritage Foundation or whatever. And I got to maximize my share and if you get more than I get less. This is so wrong. This is so wrong. And I'll give a shout out actually to one of your associates. I have many friends on the staff of Heritage. One of them is Andy Alvastro. And he and I were having a conversation, and he mentioned what a wonderful thing it is that there's about 500,000 people in America who support the Heritage Foundation financially, members of the Heritage Foundation. That's amazing. And I'm thankful for that as a former Heritage intern. And again, as the head of an organization that wouldn't exist if not for the Heritage Foundation. But Andy said, one way to think about that is that's more than anybody else has. And right. And that's great. And clap ourselves in the back. Another way to look at it is, you know, in 2020, something like 72 million people voted for a conservative candidate. So we should be talking to the other 71.5 million.
Amen.
That's what I call thinking expansively. And that's a financial example, but I think there's many, many, many examples of, you know, at the end of the day, maybe it's another way of saying, you know, not just are we here to just talk about these ideas or are we here to enact them? Another way to say it is, are we here to be an insular group of a certain amount of people that it is what it is today? Or do we want to welcome so many more Americans into this work? Well, I think you know my answer. I think that has to be not just my answer and your answer. I know it's your answer. That has to be our movement's answer. Sometimes we think too small. We need to think expansively.
So two final questions. The first of them is, what advice do you give to someone listening to this or watching this who says, I'm living in XYZ state, I really want to get involved, I have a limited amount of time, where do I go to find out what to do, what can I do that's feasible for me? So there's not necessarily skepticism by people saying this, there's actually realism about what an individual person can do. You have a lot of experience in what you do, and you're someone I've grown to know has real clarity about what individual people can do. What homework do you want to give someone who asks you that question?
I love the question. And the first thing I would say is what not to do.
Oh, that's good.
No one ever saved this country by yelling at the television. I know too many conservatives who act like that's actually a way to save the country. Just watch something, get upset, yell about it. That's not what George Washington did. It's not what happened in Philadelphia in 1776. And frankly, I don't have patience for it. The only way that we will create change is to get involved in the process. And if you're not willing to do that, well, then you're not as conservative as you say. Sorry, I'm from Philadelphia. Sometimes we state hard truths. And I think at the end of the day, that's a fork in the road for every conservative is, are you here to be professionally angry or are you here to be part of the solution? I'm here to be part of the solution. Sometimes I get angry, but I'm here to be part of the solution. So that's what not to do, right? Is do not think you can change the world by yelling at the television or even by watching an excellent podcast and clapping. I don't want your flaws. I want your partnership. I want your involvement. Okay. So that's enough about what not to do. What to do? Kevin, I honestly believe most people watching this have no idea how influential they can be in changing this country. And at the risk of, you know, being somewhat, you know, offensive, I believe that that influence is very, very important in Washington. I believe it is so much greater at the state and local level.
It is.
I have lived this. I mentioned, for example, accomplishing bipartisan pension reform here in Pennsylvania. I watched one guy who called his state representative change 5 votes on that bill because he effectively convinced the one lawmaker that he was talking to vote for the bill. And then that lawmaker went and flipped 4 of his colleagues who were really listening to him. And I share that story because I think most people, especially if you're a conservative and you're upset, and rightly upset, about what's going on in our country, you think, these people aren't going to listen to me. Listen, there's a lot of them that won't. I got that. But especially at the state level, especially if you're smart about it and you get some friends to do it with you, it is amazing the impact
that a small number of constituents can have on actually moving elected officials towards embracing conservative policy positions. And it's not an excuse to say, I live in a state that voted for thus and such a blue candidate. We've talked about how Pennsylvania disproves that. But even if you live in an area of the state that is very progressive, I tell people all the time, adopt an elected official. You've heard of adopt the highway? Adopt an elected official. Find the closest conservative to you and become their friend. I can assure you that if they are dealing with a swamp, they need a friend and they will welcome you. And then you probably know two or three others and you can encourage that person in the right direction. So I would urge anybody, get involved. Now, of course, should you write a check to the Heritage Foundation too? Yes. And find organizations to support philanthropically. That's part of it as well. But this is not a yelling at the TV exercise, and this is not just a write a check exercise. Sweat equity is what we need.
What I love about that response, among other things, is part of the craft of politics for us as conservatives is building a community, which perhaps, excuse me, sounds a little goofy, but really it is the mother's milk of politics. Yes. And even community exists even in Washington. It's just hard to sustain.
Yes.
Because of all the external pressures on it. Ask Speaker Mike Johnson right now about that. But at the local and state level, it's a lot easier. And what you said about adopting a friend, adopting a legislator, adopting a city councilman, a mayor, I have a few new friends who are supporters of Heritage who said, you know, they're retired guys and they said, I want to do something. I said, well, I've got a few members of Congress who need some adoptive parents.
Yeah.
And they're doing that.
That's wonderful.
And they're all loving it, even beyond the politics, Charles. I mean, this is the important thing is that politics is about the apostolate of friendship. And when we can do that for our elected officials, even when we have those moments of differences of opinion, when we can at least understand one another and we're not yelling at the TV. All right. I always ask a final question about someone's hopefulness. And I usually frame it the way I'm going to frame it now, because it would seem like there are a lot of things we as Americans would cite as problems in our country. I posited earlier that the United States is weaker than it was 40 or 50 years ago. Again, with the caveat, I don't think that's irreversible. And in fact, we can get a lot of clarity from that about what needs to change. But you could, if you wanted, in Pennsylvania, in spite of things that are going well, decide, today it's just a little much. But I know you well enough to know that you woke up this morning hopeful about the future. What's the substance behind that motivation to be so hopeful?
There's two pieces, Kevin, and I'll give them to you both straight up. First is I believe in the sovereignty of God, and I couldn't do this work without that. And the second is I see the results every single day of doing what we've talked about. This is hard work. There are days when it sucks. But everything we talked about, playing offense, getting involved in the process, putting in the sweat equity, adopting an elected official, in season and out of season, all of it, it works. There are very few places, unfortunately, where our movement is doing it at scale. But where we are, it works. So we need to do it everywhere.
Thank you for that advice. And Charles Mitchell, more than anything, thank you for your leadership here of Commonwealth Foundation and Commonwealth Partners. Also for being a great friend, Heritage Alumnus of the Year Award, all of these accolades. Most importantly, you're just a great human being and a great American. And I'm proud to call you a friend.
Thank you, Kevin. The pride is mutual. And thank you for your leadership in almost America.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us for this special on-location episode of The Kevin Roberts Show. Much more important than The Kevin Roberts Show is the great story of Charles Mitchell and the great work at Commonwealth Foundation. Be sure to follow him and them. And even if you aren't in Pennsylvania, keep tabs on them because it kind of sounds like I'm going to be buying Charles some barbecue. Most of all, if you're kind of discouraged, I hope we lifted your spirits. Keep your chin up. We are winning and we ultimately will win. Take care.
The Kevin Roberts Show is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. The executive producer is Crystal Kate Bonham. Sound designed by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and Tim Kennedy. For more information and to subscribe, please visit heritage.org.